My name is Bruce Berner, and I teach at the law school at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And this week, we're looking at a variety of issues in connection with the civil justice system. Last week, we looked at the criminal side, people generally who engage in pretty bad behavior, and we need to deal with them in a kind of a punishment mode. But this week, we're talking about people who hurt other people, almost always accidentally. Not 100% of the time, but almost always. And we're looking at the system which attempts to compensate the victims of injury. We're going to be talking today about products liability, and we're going to head toward the McDonald's coffee case, which many of you probably read some accounts of. In the course of getting there, I want to first give you a little background, a little context for understanding that case. And before we get to the coffee case, I've got a little chainsaw case for you on the pink sheet that I want us to think about, too. In some ways, the chainsaw case is the same, and in some ways, it's different. We looked last night at a variety of systems of compensating people who are injured. In this country, we kind of divide them into three categories. One would be a system which depends on first-party insurance. That is, you buy insurance to protect yourself. Fire insurance is of that type, of course, but you can buy insurance for a hospitalization, doctor bills, other things. You buy that yourself. When you get hurt, you collect from that insurance. Most of us carry collision insurance on our motor vehicle, so that if the vehicle gets hurt through our fault or someone else's, we get paid. Other systems are statutory systems like workers' compensation, but the principal one that we rely on is the system that we know as the torts system. Interesting thing about the word, which we didn't talk about last night, torts are not a dessert, okay, although that's everybody's first reaction to them. Actually, very little is known about why tort was the word that came to be applied to a civil wrong. And tort, the classic definition, is an actionable civil wrong. So it's not criminal. On the other hand, it's actionable in the sense that you can be liable for it. It appears to have come from the French word for twisted. And maybe you can all make some deep connections as to whether or not some of these cases seem ultimately twisted to you. The tort system has three basic kinds of cases that it looks at. The first one are what are called intentional torts. And they are pretty non-controversial. We're talking about people who assault or batter other persons, or who falsely imprison them and cause them damage, or who convert their property or trespass on their land and damage it. Fairly common cases, uncontroversial. Usually we can't generate a lot of sympathy for those defendants. After all, they're hurting people on purpose. About the only time you can get a little sympathy going is if the amount of damage that they cause is way beyond what you would have expected their actions to cause. So you try to hurt someone a little, and you hurt them a lot. Even there, though, to the extent there's controversy, it's about the proportionality of the recovery, and not about whether there should be any recovery at all. The second one, and we looked at this one last night, is negligence. That's the most common one. When we think of automobile accidents or people who are careless and hurt other people, we're really talking about negligence actions. And we looked at those last night with a variety of hypotheticals. In one sense, of course, both of those types of cases involve what we might loosely call fault. And we usually talk about fault-based liability. The fault over here, of course, is that you meant something wrong. The fault over here is that you were careless, that you didn't take sufficient precautions with what you were doing. And it's not perhaps a moral fault, although I think we could argue about whether or not it is, but it's certainly, we would say, at least a lack of prudence. And therefore, we don't feel all that bad when we make you pay a little money to the person who was injured. The third type, which is of much more recent vintage, really didn't come into its own until the 1960s, is called tort liability, which is strict in nature. Sometimes we talk about liability without fault. This is based less on a fault theory or a moral blame theory and more on some purely economic ideas springing from who's in the best position to both provide safety and who's in the best position to pay for injuries once they occur. This doctrine, which began in California with bad power equipment, that's where it started, and exploding Coke bottles. Those were the first two kinds of cases that led courts to look at a new theory, and those were called, and products liability cases came to be called, situations in which the product was in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous. Even if this was not the fault of the manufacturer. Now, what leads us to put liability on the manufacturer there rather than the person hurt? Let's take a quick look at the problem on the pink sheet here. And think what people on either side of this case may say. House Light Incorporated, I don't call it Home Light because I might be subject to a suit. See, so it's House Light, and no one could tell that that's a substitute for Home Light. House Light Inc. manufactures and sells a full line of power tools, including the 20-inch bar He-Man chainsaw, quote, for those willing to tackle the tough tree-cutting jobs, end quote. That's part of their advertisement. Jack Caesar, who fancied himself a lumberjack, even though he was really a cost accountant for a firm that sells doilies, I don't want to offend anyone there, he could be a wimp law professor just as easily. Every time I hear a chainsaw turn on, I kind of back up. You know, what's that noise? Bought a He-Man for use in cutting trees to get firewood. During his third trip out with his new saw, as he was cutting a tree, the bar split in half, and the chain ripped huge gouges in Jack's stomach and arms, necessitating three operations and causing great pain and permanent injury. Lest you think law teachers have an unending imagination, this is based on a whole lot of cases that look very much like this. It wasn't someone who worked for a doily company, I made that up, but the operative facts are the same. Experts for Jack and House Light agree. That's, first of all, unusual in these cases. Usually, we're going to see in the McDonald's case that the experts have a great deal of disagreement on the scientific level here. But I didn't want to have them deal with that here, so we have them agree that the bar broke because of a deep flaw in the metal of the bar. And a physicist could tell us what that might be. Assume it is agreed that such a flaw cannot ever be detected before rupture. So our ability to find out which bars are bad is beyond us scientifically at this point. And by the way, that's true for a lot of products. Yeah. There are certain kind of defects which we simply don't have the capacity to check for. There's another interesting group where you can check without any difficulty at all for whether they're defective by testing them. The problem is that the test entails destroying them. Yeah. That turns out not to be real efficient in the long run either, since you have to destroy every one before you market it. Before rupture, and that it can be expected to occur in about one saw out of 15 million saws, and that it affects all chainsaws, not just those manufactured by House Light. Although all chainsaw manufacturers are aware of the problem, none of them, including House Light, informs or warns purchasers of the problem. Jack sues House Light in a strict product liability action. What are the main issues and arguments? Let's start with the question, there's been a loss suffered here. No question there's been a loss suffered in the form of doctor bills and in the form of pain and suffering. Which of the two parties ought to pay for it? Assuming we don't have an insurance system in place, which we'll cover it, as between Jack and House Light, who ought to pay for it and why?
What are you talking about? The one who sold it to the manufacturer? When you said which?
Let's group them together. Let's group the whole manufacturing chain down through the sellers and consider them one person, because legally we can sue the seller, but the seller can throw it all the way back to the manufacturer anyway. So let's select the manufacturer or Jack.
Manufacturer.
Why?
What did they do wrong?
I suppose they didn't warn the super pockets that this might happen.
Okay, didn't warn it.
Although I'm surprised, I mean, I would think that it would be a matter of course that any of these kind of pieces of equipment that have the potential of cutting, that there'd be some warning on there that this is dangerous equipment. And I think that might be sufficient. It is dangerous equipment.
Yes, and generally speaking, you don't have to warn about those dangers which are patent to the ordinary user.
Is that right?
That is, if it's an obvious danger, like you don't have to, when you sell a knife, put sharp. And to the extent that someone just cuts themselves with a knife, there's another doctrine called products which are unavoidably unsafe. And when they're unavoidably unsafe, we let the manufacturer off the hook. If Jack had taken this chainsaw and just let it down, they can't make a chainsaw which won't cut when it contacts something. That would pretty much defeat the purpose of the chainsaw, right? But this is not a danger. The danger of the bar flying apart is probably not a danger that the average user of the chainsaw is aware of. So it may be a case in which we can require some warning.
If they're aware that 1 out of 15 million or whatever is, I mean, does it almost become a statistical probability that there will, that at some point somebody will get hurt, and therefore you ought to account for that in your sales, and that you ought to be basically self-insured and be willing to pay off on those occasions when it does happen?
Okay. Yeah, and that's different from the warning question. This problem is a kind of a real interesting problem in terms of warning. Because it may be that even those of us who are users would end up conceding that this may not be a very good case for a warning. It happens so seldom, the inefficiency of the warning may kick in, and you may say, what you're going to do is make a lot of people nervous. 1 in 15 million, after all, I mean, that's a pretty large number. It means that the odds of your Mr. Coffee blowing up in your house are probably 150 times greater. And there's a lot of Mr. Coffee suits. The warning issue is interesting, but let's get rid of it by now assuming that they put that warning in there. Warning, 1 in 15 million of these blows apart. Okay, so we can cover them by warning. Now we come to your argument, which is even if there is a warning, economically, the chainsaw manufacturer is in a better position to spread that risk, either or both, by buying insurance against it or by making it a price add-on. That is, if you simply add a penny or so to the cost of each saw, create a contingency fund over here, now that will be ready. And the nice thing about this one is it happens to the saws that everybody makes. So there's no competitive disadvantage in forcing them to do that, because all manufacturers would have to do that. Yes?
Is there a category called act of God, which just seems to sort of be related to an inherent flaw that cannot be either detected or sounds like prevented?
There is a category called act of God, but it's basically an insurance law, where a lot of insurance policies have language which contracts out, will not cover, or excludes acts of God. There's nothing like that here in connection with defective products. I find the whole act of God doctrine is very interesting. If you think about it, when you go through the act of God cases, and there are a lot of them, mostly in insurance law, here's what you find: floods, conflagrations, plagues. What kind of God do these people have in mind? It's the only acts of God that the law recognizes. In fact, Art Laff at the Yale Law School used to say, the legal definition of an act of God is that which no reasonable God would do. They're always bad things. There are never any acts of God that are good. But yeah, basically the argument won't play here because we're not looking for fault anyway. I think we could probably say in this case that House Light has not done anything which we would say is faulty. We would also, however, say that Jack didn't do anything which we would say is false. So it's not the whole answer to say, well, House I didn't do anything wrong. Well, neither did Jack. The question is, where do we want the loss to rest? Well, the early law said the loss rests on Jack because the law only moved, that's where the loss fell. Right? The world acted in such a way that Jack got hurt, and for Jack to put that loss on someone else, law being an inherently conservative institution, requires them to make some proof as to why it's better off. After all, if we go back to God, God chose Jack to get hurt. So how, you know, can Jack prove to us that God was wrong, I guess, and someone else ought to pay for it? All right. So that's the Saw case. That's the manufacturing defect case. And those cases are ones in which it is really clear that the liability is without fault. Even the manufacturer who can do nothing about it ends up paying in these cases because economically, without a first-party insurance system that covers everyone, this is the best place to put it. By the way, there's another reason to put it on the manufacturer. Wholly apart from the fact that the manufacturer can shift the loss better. Which of the two is in the best position to engage in some research and technology to advance science to the point where we can pick this defect up? See, if you relieve the manufacturer, there's absolutely no incentive now for that manufacturer to work on this problem. But if they keep paying, at some point they may say, you know, maybe it would cost us less instead of paying these claims every time they come off, which is not all that often, with 1 in 15 million, but often enough. Maybe we should put one of the eggheads that work in R&T on this. You know, they're funny guys. They have computers and CAD drawings, and we have no idea what they're doing. But maybe, you know, they have all this weird training. Maybe they can fix this. So that's called the theory of the best safety provider. The manufacturer is the best safety provider here. There are a lot of situations where you lose the lawsuit because it turns out you were the best safety provider. You were more able to look after yourself than someone else was to look after you. Now we move to the design defect. This is a much different kind of case and in many ways much scarier to manufacturers. Because a manufacturing defect case, we sometimes call that a unit defect or a non-generic defect. That means this product, which was defective, is unlike all the other products. The other 14,999,999 chainsaws didn't have a deep flow. So this was an unusual chainsaw. The design defect cases are worse for the manufacturers because the theory in this case is that every product of that type is in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous. That is to say, it is designed in such a way that it has that condition. If you're a manufacturer, this one really gets your attention because every product you sell, if it's in that condition, is a tort waiting to happen. And so you can begin to see that the insurance costs, the price add-on, the competitive kind of concerns are much greater. What we're going to use today as the design defect case is the McDonald's coffee case. I want you to assume, I'm going to ask you to do something which I know is repugnant to many. I want you to assume that you're a lawyer. And I want you to assume that a client presents herself in your office with a history of some pretty serious burn injuries here. Stella Liebeck is her name. Stella is 81 years old. She has, over the past year, been undergoing a series of operations and other medical procedures for burn injuries, which she tells you she received when she purchased a cup of coffee at McDonald's at the drive-up window as a passenger in the car and spilled it on herself in the car. And got these injuries. And I want to start, I will be glad to play Stella or anyone else that you want to talk to. And I want to know how you would go about investigating this case, because even you as a lawyer have as your first reaction, this lady spilled coffee on herself and now wants to sue someone else and throw the loss on them. Do you have any questions you want to ask me?
Do you have palsy?
Hmm?
Do you have palsy?
No, I'm just 81.
I'd want to see the medical record to make sure that she'd receive real care. I mean, that there was some kind of an assessment for the burn.
Okay. We'll go get the hospital records for you. She can tell us a little bit about what happened to her, but what we will find when we look at the hospital record is that Stella's medical bills exceed $10,000 out of pocket. Let's see where the rest of it is here. She was in the hospital for 7 days and returned three separate times for more skin grafts.
Where was she burned?
She suffered severe second and third degree burns across her inner thighs, buttocks, and labia. On the coffee. She had taken the coffee and she was sitting in the passenger side, set it between her legs to take the top off to put the cream and sugar in. See, the cream and sugar were delivered in the bag, not in the coffee. And it's as she's taking the lid off that she spills it. Thus the locus of the injuries there on her lap.
So she was not driving at the time. She was not driving the car. She was a passenger in the car?
She was a passenger in the car.
Was the car moving?
The car, moving. The car was parked at this time. They had gotten their breakfast and then moved up and ate at a parking space. Her grandson was driving the car. So she's in the car with her grandson.
Yes. Did McDonald's and the restaurant provide help? Did they call the emergency room? Did they do anything to help her? Did she ask?
They drove, the grandson simply drove directly to the hospital. There's no indication that the McDonald's wouldn't have helped if she had gone in. They have a pretty good history if someone was hurt on the premises of contacting the right authorities and reacting. Right.
Did she have coffee here before and complain
yes.
about it?
Had she yes. complained about it? No, she had never complained about it before, but she had drunk McDonald's coffee before.
That was my question. Had she performed this often, had she done this before, was she familiar with their product to know, to have an idea of what the temperature would be like on an average basis?
Right. She'd never spilled it on herself. So she hadn't had that kind of contact with it in terms of the heat, but she had drunk it before, so she had some sense of how hot it was.
Has she ever sued anybody else?
Never.
In a situation like that?
Never. 81 years.
I'm feeling better about her.
First lawsuit. Huh?
I'm feeling a lot better about her than I did when I first heard it in the paper.
Had that McDonald's had other complaints about the temperature of their coffee?
Yes.
How much greater is the temperature than a usual cup of coffee?
What was the temperature of their coffee? Yes.
Okay. Let's get into the temperature question. What is the temperature of the coffee? First of all, if you're the lawyer, how would you find out? I mean, the coffee isn't around anymore, and if it were, you can be sure it's down to room temperature by now.
Is there a
what does it take
policy regarding serving of coffee for what that McDonald's has? Do they have a prescription or a recipe or something that says what is McDonald's coffee served at?
Was that policy followed?
It turns out McDonald's has a policy for everything. Right down to where the tables and chairs go and when you can move them and when you can't and how many of those little balls are in the kids' playroom where they jump in, exactly how many per cubic foot of space. So yes, the McDonald's policy manual. Interesting question, was it followed in this case? That's an interesting question to ask the franchisee on the stand. Did you follow McDonald's policy? The brass of McDonald's is present in the courtroom, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, we followed.
Could there have been a flaw in the coffee maker that had kind of the thermostat had gone awry or something like that?
that's certainly possible, but that's checked pretty frequently. And anyway, when we find the McDonald's policy manual, we find almost all we need to
run the temperature for their coffee. What do they want their temperature to be when they?
They want it. Let me get these numbers exactly right because the numbers are.
180 degrees.
I think it is.
No, more than that.
More than that.
More than that. McDonald's operations and training manual require its coffee to be brewed at 195 to 205.
Wow. Ooh. Oh, man, that's hot.
Taste buds everywhere.
I went up to the just before I came down here. I went back into the kitchen here.
Yeah, right.
I'd asked them if there was anyone there who knew the temperature at which it was brewed back there. They said, "Well, the Starbucks manual calls for 190 to 200." Mm-hmm. Starbucks is we're going to see in a minute, the closest to McDonald's, but he said, but we don't brew it that high. And we'll see why in a moment. What the lawyer in this case did was to do a survey of all the other restaurants in the area. One very good indicator of whether a product is in a defective condition is to find out how does it compare with other kinds of products in the area. And they found out that no local restaurant served it at more than 160 degrees. Okay, that was the highest. They found in local restaurants 130 to 160. But you know, if you're McDonald's, what can you say about that?
Is that in the cup when they serve it?
They serve it.
So in the brewer, it probably was much hotter.
No, McDonald's wants you to give it to the customer at 195 to 205.
Well, that's because people are probably taking it somewhere else and it has time to cool down.
You're not supposed to drink it in the
How very interesting. In a restaurant, when do you, a regular sit-down restaurant, when do you get served your coffee?
Right
when
now.
You're going to drink it.
Sure.
So you eat your breakfast first, then they bring you the coffee. But at McDonald's, you buy it all at once because it's fast food, right? And you buy it all at once, and so they say, well, you know, we know they're not going to drink their coffee for a while. It takes time to work your way through an Egg McMuffin, after all, right? So it's going to be a little later. We know it's going to cool down at a certain rate. And at the drive-thru window, people may be taking it to work, church, somewhere else. Wherever they're going, they may be taking that coffee there.
A lot of people drink it right there. They just get a coffee right there to drink.
It turns out that you can't drink it right away.
No, it's too
hot. It's too hot to drink. It's too hot. You're going to get third-degree burns on your lips. We're going to look in a moment at what the burn experts tell us here about what the capacities are. By the way, the other way to find out how hot the coffee in this particular case was is by inferring it from her injury.
Yeah.
And with experts who can say you can't get these kinds of injuries unless you get fluid at a particular temperature. Yeah.
Now, that lady has got this before with the little plastic cap and
right.
The foam cup inside.
Right.
Now, were these cups and caps, was the fit different? Was that a factor so that when she went to open it, she...
That's what happened. She went to open it and it flew all over.
Yeah, but it was tighter or it acted in some way different from the other. And as far as the temperature of the coffee, I don't think that's got much to do with it. If you have a lid that you've got a monkey with and all of a sudden it jumps and then you throw it on yourself, that probably is what caused the throwing. Or maybe she was fumbling with that thing. I don't know. Fumbled with the coffee when she didn't do it before.
Particularly if she's done it before, if she's done the exact same process before and hasn't happened, what is different this time that she spilled it this time and not before? She's like,
And what's the difference that should make McDonald's responsible?
Was there a warning on the cup?
No, that the coffee's hot? No warning on the cup. Not clear what that kind of a warning at that level will do.
Warnings now.
Raise your hand.
Now, that's right.
Raise your hand if you've ever done something to hurt yourself.
And now raise your hand again if the only time you hurt yourself doing that particular action was the first time you did that action.
Oh,
so you can do it the second time. I mean, something is different. In fact, Mrs. Liebig concedes that she had done something wrong. She concedes that she is careless in connection with Opal. Which tells us what? Which tells us that part of the fault of this is with her. Does it tell us that all of the fault is with her?
Well, it's a precarious place to put a hot cup of coffee.
Oh, no, it isn't.
You probably...
She can tell you why she put it there.
In the ransom and have a little pull-up,
you know.
Well, the nature of her grandson's vehicle was such that there was no place to set it. That was just the kind of vehicle he was driving
too.
Around. Huh?
Let's sue them, too.
Let's sue him.
No, sure. The car manufacturer. Yeah.
The car manufacturer. Right. That's tomorrow. That's tomorrow. We're going to sue car manufacturers tomorrow. Yeah.
What was she wearing?
Pants.
Okay.
She wasn't wearing summer clothes. She was wearing.
No, she was wearing polyester pants and underwear.
She ought to be sued for wearing polyester. But she's 81. She's 81. Oh, that's right. Never mind. That's right.
Just a penalty for bad taste, right?
So your car was parked.
Car was parked.
Is there a hole in the floor? Was there a hole in the floor where she was? Because she could put it on the floor between her feet.
I suppose she could have.
Maybe she would have.
She's 81, and she's in a kind of a truck with a fairly high seat.
Yeah. Oh, in a truck.
Yeah.
But there's more space to the...
Yeah. Her testimony is that there was no convenient place to put it. I think, you know, when you look back on these things, then you always say, you know, I really could have. Find all the things, but at that point, you know, and she says, there's no question, I was careless, I shouldn't have done it.
What'd she say she did wrong?
The way she took it off, she probably pulled too hard on it, and it wasn't holding it solidly enough with this hand as she's prying with that hand.
Well, would the coffee at 160 burn someone? Not as severely, obviously, but would it burn someone?
Well, you want to know about that, huh?
Yeah.
You want to know what the chemistry and physics of all this is. Turns out to be kind of interesting. One of the things that really hurt McDonald's in this case is some of their own testimony about how little they knew about how this works. In fact, there was a McDonald's executive who took the stand and in a prior case. He also took the stand in this case. And in the prior case, he testified that he himself was amazed to learn how serious the injuries could be from coffee of this temperature. We don't know that he's employed any longer. He wasn't just in the franchise at that particular location. He was an executive at the top, and he confesses himself amazed at the differences. Here's what the two experts say, and it's interesting how the two experts come at the problem differently. A McDonald's expert testified that any coffee hotter than 130 degrees could produce third-degree burns. Any coffee hotter than 130 could produce third-degree burns. So what? So what is the jury to draw from that? The lowest that any restaurant serves it is 130 degrees. So what difference does it make then? Once it's over 130, you can get third-degree burns out of it.
Are third-degree burns the worst?
Yes.
It wouldn't be that expensive, though. I don't think it's, you know.
No, third-degree is it's just sore and red.
No, that's what the skin is actually caused. The skin bubbles or
shit. It's the worst of the three types. It's the third-degree, I think, means that it reaches the third layer of skin, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's like first degree sunburn type,
right.
Second degree blisters,
right.
Third degree.
No questions, the worst. That's what the McDonald expert testified to, and it turns out that that's all the research that they had done in-house, was to find out that at 130 you could produce third degree burns.
But that's if you have a whole pot and you can, like, continually renew it and leave it on the skin for long periods of time.
here's what the expert for the plaintiff tells us. Physicist.
You're going to be a slip and fall person, aren't you?
It takes less than 3 seconds to produce a third degree burn at 190 degrees. About 12 to 15 seconds at 180 degrees. And about 20 seconds at 160 degrees. When we get to 130 degrees, it takes about 3 minutes. So you have time. You have time to take it off. But the interesting thing about this case, the theory is in place to have this woman recover, and most lawyers weren't surprised when they heard about it. Although the way that the press covered it, they cover it so minimally that people get the other reaction. The other thing about this case is that McDonald's made a lot of said a lot of things at trial, which must have inflamed the jury. In addition to some of the other arguments, they suggest that Stella was responsible for the severity of her burns due to her failure to remove the scalding clothing sufficiently promptly. Sufficiently promptly here is within 3 seconds, which would have included her pants and underwear to have avoided all of the harm. They also argue, can you imagine? I mean, if you're the lawyer for McDonald's, this is where you're getting under the table. They also argue that her age may have caused her injuries to be more severe, since older skin is thinner and more vulnerable to injury.
Oh, jeez. You're the plaintiff's lawyer, you're just drooling.
That is true, but that's who they're serving the coffee to. Yeah. They can't be surprised at her age. They're handing her the coffee, right? Yeah.
And what was McDonald's reaction initially when she approached them?
Yeah.
Presuming that she didn't go right to a lawyer, she went to McDonald's and said, I would like you to pay for my medical benefit bills.
They said no. They said it's.
I bet they wish they hadn't.
Yeah, well,
because she did approach them directly, right? I mean, she did to legal.
She did, and what she approached them for was for them to pay the bills. Just the bills, all she talked about. Anything else you want to know?
There's another correlation with the polyester. Anyone that's had any fire training knows that polyester holds the heat and melts, and it will stay hotter longer. Right. And probably that 3 second rule you talked about is probably it's even quicker than that
at
lower temperatures.
Right.
Because of the nature of the plastic, which polyester is.
One thing that you have to do in these cases is to separate two things. If you conflate them together, it always makes it harder to analyze it. There's a difference between how did the accident happen? Whose fault is it that the accident happened? But the second question is, how severe are the results? Let me give you a hypothetical, which is not a real case, but there's a real case quite similar to it. Let's assume that consumers of motor vehicles want their trunks to be waterproof. That is, they don't like it when water seeps into the trunk and it gets the things in the trunk wet. Let's assume that a car manufacturer finds out that the best waterproofing by far to put around the trunk lining is nitroglycerin. There are side effects, or actually effects, to hitting the back of this car. That is, it will explode, but only if it's hit at more than 25 miles per hour. Now, could a manufacturer say this? The manufacturer could say, look, if that car runs into anything at 25 miles an hour or more, or anything runs into it, it will be someone else's fault. I mean, cars don't collide with things at that speed unless someone is at fault. Something's gone wrong. Either you're backing up too fast or someone's coming up. So we'll build it this way. When that first one explodes, what do you think? Do you think they ought to be liable?
Sure.
Because the question there is not so much who caused the collision. That's the individuals in the case. The problem is, when you build cars, you have to foresee that some of them are going to get hit at that speed. And so the car has to be built in such a way that it doesn't deliver more injury than is necessary in that kind of collision. You get into some real difficult kind of engineering questions, how much safety is enough safety, and then there are certain design limitations. And now you get the trade-off in our case between wet things in the trunk and cars blowing up, right? Anything else you want to?
You mentioned that the McDonald's executive testified previously and done poorly. Had they had previous spills, previous cases where they've been sued for hot coffee?
Many.
And they've done nothing about the temperature of the coffee?
Correct. Despite over 700 burn reports, and this is over the this is over the previous 10 years, and this is now these are burn reports which made it officially to McDonald's. So there may have been many other people burned that in which they never filed complaints. Despite over 700 burn reports, McDonald's had not consulted burn experts, and still had no plans to change its policies or procedures. When I told you McDonald's expert showed up, that was an expert they hired for purposes of the trial. They didn't have any experts on staff. They hadn't looked at it, even though there had been 700 burn reports. They had settled many prior burn claims for amounts up to and exceeding $500,000. Mrs. Liebig's bills were $10,000. After the lawyer got involved, they offered her
$800.
$800?
$800.
The jury doesn't find out about that. But the interesting thing there is most defense lawyers wouldn't make an offer of that type. Either you make a reasonable offer or you offer nothing. You simply take the position that we're not responsible. To offer $800 has its own kind of...
Was that based on sort of things? Where did they get $800?
Huh?
What's that based on? Where did they get $800? I mean, they didn't just make that up, okay?
It could be based on proportionality, saying that, you know, 90% of the problem is hers, and so she ought to pay 90%
of the bills. Maybe that was it.
Okay, yeah, that would be 92%. We'll take 8% of the responsibility. The actual bills are $10,000. We'll pay $800. Plus, there's a kind of a nuisance value to all cases. One of the interesting things about tort cases is, we talked a little bit last night about the kind of system it is, it almost always produces overcompensation in small cases. If you have a very small case with very small injuries, you almost always get paid more than what we would say in some objective sense is fair, because it's just cheaper to pay that case off than to try it. It's very expensive to try the case. Most serious injuries are undercompensated. That's really the problem with the system. See, many people wouldn't guess that, because the press covers these spectacular cases so deeply, you expect, oh, you know, everybody is getting zillions and zillions of dollars when they have a serious injury. Not most serious injury cases are well undercompensated. The small cases tend to get overcompensated.
Was she insured?
Hmm?
Did she
no.
have medical insurance?
No.
She
had Medicare.
Yeah.
On a little different tack, why was McDonald's being so niggardly about this? Why would you speculate that McDonald's was responding so?
Don't know. Different companies have different philosophies about how to deal with cases, just as different insurance companies have different philosophies. I used to practice this kind of thing in New Jersey, and we found out that at least in New Jersey, you could kind of set up as polarities State Farm, Allstate. State Farm would send a guy out there within 2 days and sit down, and you could often settle the case right there, before you even file your action. Their strategy was to pay off cases early and as fairly as they could. They don't pay any lawyers there, for one thing. They keep their legal staff way down. That's their strategy. The Allstate strategy was, if they were going to settle, it's when you walk into the courtroom. That is, everything else. And sometimes they wouldn't settle till after the plaintiff's case, because they counted on a lot of plaintiffs simply not wanting to go into the courtroom and take the stand. Because for many people, that's one of the most terrifying things they can imagine, is to have to testify in court. I had one lady, she was going to settle for $300 on what was a pretty severe injury. She was just absolutely terrified. She testified, Allstate now upped the offer to $1,500. And she basically, I said, they're up to $1,500. We wanted $300 at one time. They were offering, you know, $90, some ridiculous thing. And she said, go tell them to. Because she had testified at that point. That's what she worried about. Now she wants to stick it to them. They stuck it to her. She got $15,000.
Oh boy.
Pretty good, you know, for being willing to take $300 in the morning. By the afternoon, she was kind of a veteran, you know. But so Allstate did it that way. What we get different things in the record here. I don't know in McDonald's how often the franchisee has much to say. I assume that this is pretty much a decision from the top. We're going to talk about the Pinto case tomorrow, and we're going to see there also Ford and General Motors. They both had the same problem with these cars with the fuel system. They took the exact opposite approach in how to handle cases. Settlement right up front, keep it out of the press, and stonewall. So they, you know, and that works out different ways. And each of them has its good point.
I was wondering on this, if you would guess that the sort of rate of injury on McDonald's coffee was less than on this chain stock. My guess is that it probably is. It's probably less than 1 in 15 million people gets injured by that coffee. So, that, I mean, where we were sort of sympathetic here, we seem to be less sympathetic.
But how many chainsaws sold compared to how many McDonald's cups of coffee?
Well, in the period that generated 700 burn reports, we have over 1 billion cups served.
Right.
It's close, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. It's math.
Yes.
That's why I asked you.
That's the visible complexity. That's right. Yeah.
This is so contrary to their image, okay? The lack of correction. Would they have had other problems, other legal problems that were bigger than this one over a period of time that they would have paid more attention to?
It's possible. It's also possible that that this case got into the hands of the wrong person in their own legal department, someone who was new, who didn't know the track record. They didn't expect this case to come up and bite them either. They brought in an mediator. The two sides agreed to sit down with a mediator who listened to the facts. This was in California, and California does a lot of this rent-a-judge. Mediator. They're retired judges. We call them rent-a-judge. That's okay. He listened to both sides of the case and recommended that McDonald's settle for $225,000 based on recoveries in prior cases of burn injuries of this type. And he said a jury would be likely to award that amount. McDonald's rejected the recommendation. They were willing to go through the mediation. But they thought they could fare better at trial. They didn't think they were going to take a hit for $225,000. Well, what did they take a hit for? Let's just go through that. First of all, the jury decided that Mrs. Liebeck was 20% responsible and the McDonald's was 80% responsible. So whatever damages they were going to find, it's another kind of defective product. It just isn't unreasonably dangerous. You can't hurt yourself on this one.
Like a fly.
So it's 80% McDonald's. Actually, you got to. It's a defective teacher who doesn't know how to use these, right? 80% McDonald's, 20% plaintiff. All law students know the Greek letter pi is plaintiff, the Greek letter delta is defendant.
Okay. Do you know how they came up with that? Or?
You never know how a jury comes up with that because the jury is the classic a responsible agency. They don't have to tell us how they came up with it. There's a wonderful case in which we find out after the case that the jury resolved the case because one of the jurors had a dream and heard a voice in the dream telling her how this had gone down, as she put it. She was kind of a colorful character. And she told the other jurors, and they thought that was as good a reason as they had. So we never know how a jury's going. We give them some instructions. We give them some instructions. My guess is that the jury's got a lot going on in its head, and that maybe who is at fault is, even for them, in part a question of who's in the best position to pay.
We don't know that. And we don't tell them that they can do that, but we don't know that they don't. All right. So what they do then is they give her, they award her, they fix her damages, her actual damages for medical bills and pain and suffering at $200,000. That's what they assess. Usually there's a formula, it depends on the kind of case. Lawyers usually talk about some number times specials. And specials are out-of-pockets. The exact medical expenses, lost wages, and some kind of a multiplier then is put to that to try to evaluate a case. In this kind of case, the multiplier tends to be pretty high because burn cases have a lot of pain and suffering and a lot of skin grafts and all kind of other things. Very complicated. It's going to affect her a long time. So the multiplier, what they do use here, it appears to be a multiplier of something like 20. So when we get to 200,000, then we deduct 40,000 because that's 20%. So they fix her compensatory damages at $160,000. At that point, McDonald saved $65,000 by not listening to the mediator. Okay. Unfortunately, the jury, having heard enough of a lot of the burn injuries, never hired an expert, said it was her fault because she was too old, a lot of things they shouldn't have said, they now socked them with what are called punitive damages. That amount is initially $2.7 million. Where do they get that? Where do they pick that out? That turns out, and how do they know this? Because the helpful plaintiff's lawyer has developed this wonderful information. Just thought you want to know for your own education that $2.7 million is McDonald's coffee receipts for 2 days. And as we talked about last night, the argument makes itself. If you're a trial lawyer, here's my client. You've heard the injuries she's had. This will affect her the rest of her life. Do you think it's too much to ask McDonald's to give 2 days worth of its receipts?
Oh, man.
That's just from now till Thursday. So they come up with 2.7. The judge won't let it sit. The judge engages in what's called remitter, that is, he reduces the penalty, and he ends up reducing the punitive damages to $480,000. And he picks $480,000 because many states, Indiana I know is one of them, now have a rule that punitive damages cannot be more than three times higher than compensatory damages. There has to be a proportionality. So three times $160,000 is $480,000. So this ends up being a $640,000 cup of coffee. The kiosk is a little misleading. It says $3 million. It actually ends up being a $640,000. The juror's initial response to the case before the introduction of any evidence was similar to that of similarly uninformed people around the country. They thought the case was silly. Then they heard the evidence. There's a nice parallel here with the insanity defense. When you survey people, 90% of them will tell you that they don't believe in the insanity defense, they don't trust it, they don't trust psychiatrists, and so they just don't believe in a criminal case that anybody should be not responsible. Then what happens? We have a case, and there's 12 of them, and not too often, but occasionally, all 12 of them vote that the defendant was insane and not responsible. Now, I'll leave you to do the math. But what are the mathematical odds that out of a population which only 10% of the people believe something, you will draw a group at random of 12 of those? A mathematician will tell you it is nigh unto the impossible. What happens is when people get in the courtroom and hear it and get all the facts, they get a different take on it. There's also a difference between when some guy comes up to you with a clipboard at a mall, what do you think about this? You don't give it much thought. You just throw the first one out. But in the courtroom, you're forced into what Bruce Ackerman used to call a moment of political seriousness. And you have to think a lot differently and harder about it. Here's what the judge says. The trial judge, a self-described conservative Republican of the type that are in favor of tort reform. And what's sweeping the country is called tort reform. Reform's a funny word. It just technically means reform. And that's what we're doing. We're reforming it. But it carries this baggage that we're making it better. Reforming.
And we are for defendants. Okay? A good friend of mine calls the tort reform the Tortfeasors Protection Act of 1996 because they're making it harder and harder for plaintiffs to recover. But this trial judge, who was a tort reformer, agreed with the liability finding, reduced the punitive damages to $480,000, and said, "This was not a runaway crazy jury. I was there." So, kind of interesting. Any?
Has it been appealed?
No. No.
Have they reduced the temperature to cover the car?
No, and they have no intention of reducing the temperature of the car.
Why not? It seems like the obvious, sensible thing to do. Why is McDonald's so stuck on third degree burn?
I don't know. It reminds me of my all-time favorite joke.
All right.
A man comes home after a night of out being out on the town at a local pubs doing lots of things he shouldn't have done at 5 o'clock in the morning. He is trying to sneak upstairs and get into bed. As he gets two-thirds of the way up, his wife comes out and glares at him. And he says, "I got home at 11 o'clock. I didn't want to disturb you because I know how lightly you sleep. I spent the night in the hammock on the front lawn, and I'm now coming up to shave and shower." And she says, "I took the hammock down last week." And he says, "That's my story, and I'm sticking to it." My guess is, when we raised this case in class, this was a class that, my torts class was a little bit difficult to draw out. I broached this case, some people had some things to say, and all of a sudden a guy in the back raised his hand. He owns a McDonald's franchise. And we got it on. I just basically sat for the rest of the day and didn't even have to point at people. They just started screaming. And what he says is, he doesn't mind they had to pay in this case. That's okay. It's still worth it, economically. People so want their hot coffee. If we don't get it to them hot enough, they'll go to Burger King. They'll go here. They'll go there. The facts in this case tend to suggest that they oversell that because not many other places are making the coffee that hot. But they were persuaded of that. That's what the people want. You know, there's a point at which you have to say, what if a group of 10 of us here, on the way out, said to one of the bus drivers, what we want is to experience that drive down to the lake at 50 miles an hour. Well, you know, some people are just more risk takers than others. That's really what we want. That would be the perfect capstone for the week at home. And then they did it. And then they did it. They drove the bus, and we all got hurt, and they said, that's what you want. So that's always the problem there. Well, you know, it's like giving your children what they want. Does that make you a good parent? You know, does according to the kids.
When I buy coffee at Starbucks, they have, in fact, all of those kind of coffee chains have a little thing that says, in order for our coffee to be groovier than anybody else's, we serve it at 190 degrees. Now, yeah, we do those sort of disclaimer things on field trip permission forms and everything.
Right.
Does that really protect them in any way? The fact that they told me that?
Not a whole lot. But it is part of the advertising to let you know that they're doing this for you. That's the real key that you understand.
Yeah.
This is for
PR.
For your ultimate convenience and pleasure.
Yeah.
But you know, I've often wondered then why they're not simply giving it to me. Why not give me the coffee if it's all for me? Maybe there's something in this for them. Just a thought. I don't want to get too radical here. Yeah, we got one minute.
I think their point is well taken, that proportionately,
right,
the cost is negligible to pay out these claims as long as they feel that they can get the publicity, that they can keep the customer coming to buy their stuff. It's such a minuscule risk on their part.
It's a purely economic decision. My question is, why does the general public hear this case and say, this lady shouldn't get any money at all?
Because they don't know the facts of the case.
They don't know the people. I changed my mind here.
It wasn't reported very well.
Jim's television.
Yeah, Jim's television.
What percentage of the award goes to the lawyer?
It depends. Usually what will happen is the most lawyers work at that the expenses that already been paid, and often the lawyer fronts the expenses. A lot of these plaintiffs can't afford it. So the expenses get paid back out of pocket. One third of the recovery is typical in a so-called contingent fee case. Many people with these kinds of injuries can't afford to pay the lawyer up front. They're strapped as it is with all these bills. And the nice thing about it is for the plaintiffs, if you lose this case, it doesn't cost you anything. The lawyer eats the case, including the expenses, when there is a recovery. The effect that has is if you don't have a good case, the lawyer acts as a screening device. The lawyer just doesn't take the case. This lawyer took it. Chose to take it.
The punitive damages, where do they go? Are those included in the lawyer's fees, or is he gets out of the compensatory?
No, usually out of both. And the interesting thing is punitive damages always went to the plaintiff. But now, a lot of states, Indiana just did it. Here's what's going to happen in punitive damage cases. First of all, they're going to be limited to three times the amount of the compensatories. And then three quarters of them are not going to the plaintiff. They're going to the state. And they're going to be put in a fund for victims of crime.
That's good.
Yeah, it's a political winner. It's a political winner.
Three quarters of what?
Of the punitive damages.
Mm-hmm. So the plaintiff gets less than they used to.
A lot less. So if you just got eaten by a chainsaw, you know.
But you'd right. still get the...
You'll still get your compensatories. You'll still get the amount of pain and suffering and the bills and everything else. Huh. Thank you very much. I want to excuse myself ahead of time. I am on dish team. And I am now officially 10 minutes late.